Hi, everybody. Belinda, alcoholic. Thank you, Jason. Bob and I were talking and decided I was going to go first, and I'm like, you know, he's got way more sobriety than me. I'm like, yes, okay, no problem. But I did set a timer because I they told me I have 3 hours. I want to make sure I stick into that. yeah, I'm grateful to be here. Thanks again, committee. You know, we're going to talk about, well, I'm going to talk about 10, 11, and 12, and you know, people call it the growth step, maintenance step. I don't even really know what to call it. I just think it's a way for me to continue this way of life. Real quick, I'm powerless over alcohol. I'm powerless over everything. The book tells me I have no power. There's one that has all power. That one's God. My life's unmanageable. I'm trying to manage my feelings, my thinking, my action, my inaction. I go insane quick. I better get connected to some kind of power to help me with this thinking mind and the way I act, to move into the inventory process, to help me see things from an entirely different angle, because I'm focused on the angle of you're wrong. I'm focused on the angle of I have a way and you're not doing it my way. I mean, I have a way about everything. I'm focused on an angle by this belief system that flows in my mind, the belief system that started when I was real young. And, I have become a professional minimizer and disassociator and God, and I think I know everything, man. I mean, it just still blows my mind. I think I know how I should be. I think I know how you should be. And thankfully for step five, or to have spiritual guides that help me see it from an entirely different angle. My mind can't fix my mind with my mind. Self can't fix self with self. And I can move into step six to be willing to see what's objectionable to me. And what does that really mean? It's like I live this life, morals and philosophical convictions galore, and I couldn't live up to any of it, even though I would have liked to. The inventory shows me a better way, maybe, and I can come up with a good plan. I want to be loving and kind. I want to be the best daughter and the best fiance and the best AA member. And I mean, I just want to show up the way God would have me, and I'm incapable. And thank God there's step seven and step eight, because I continue to look at this, and nine. And while I'm making amends, the book is real clear on page 84. It says in one paragraph four times, I got to continue this. In fact, it says I got to continue to take personal inventory and continue to set right any new mistakes as I go along, and I make them. You know, it says we have entered the world of the Spirit. I've got to continue for a lifetime, not just for a week, not for when I first got sober. It says for a lifetime. And I got to continue to watch. What does continue to watch mean? I got to try to stay awake. If you heard me last night, I shared about me and my, telling that artist, that's ridiculous for her price. I mean, like, I'm so asleep. I am asleep. And I fall asleep quick. I'm asleep walking around thinking I'm awake, but I'm not. And I don't know I'm asleep until I've been awakened. And once I'm awakened, I'm like, oh, my God, I've been so asleep. And I think step 10 gives me a clear idea of how to try to stay awake. I got to watch for these things. And one of the ways the 12 and 12 talks about the way I watch for these things is the disturbance within me. Oh, I can be in a meeting and you hear old Joe and old Joe sharing something. And I'm like, right there, boom, I'm disturbed. I mean, just like that. The disturbance is within me. No matter what you do to me, if you were here last night, I talked about my dad. It's not about my dad molesting me or so-and-so physically abusing me or sexually abusing me. People, the book says people are often quite wrong. I believe those people were wrong. But the disturbance is within me. And if I want to be in a place of neutrality, like one of the 10th step promises says, that I've got to go within. God's deep down within, but I got to go within and clear away the soul sickness. And step 10, 11, and 12 allows me to do that. In fact, the book right here says, you know, it says we continue to watch for, and this is what we're watching for, selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. And I'm going to give you a little idea what that looked like for me this morning. So I'm sitting there listening to Rachel, and I'm like, oh, my God, she's so good. Oh, my God, I didn't sound like that. Oh, my God, I am so embarrassed. I can't believe, oh, man, I should have said that. I can't believe I said that. That's what y'all are working with. I mean, I just can't. I look at Bob. Bob's got like 40-something years. I'm like, oh, my God, I got it. Oh. But what is that? That's the depths of my selfishness, self-centeredness. All I'm thinking about me and how I'm going to look and live in the complete opposite of the St. Francis prayer. I want you to love me and I want you to understand me, and I want you to forgive me. And the long list of that, that's just how I'm made, right? And I think step 10 allows us to watch for these things. Because when I realize I'm doing this, I can pause and I'm like, oh my God, really? Self-centered, Belinda, really? And I'm full of fear. What are people going to think of me? She's way better than me. I mean, just this constant state of comparison, this constant state of I'm not enough. I'm not young enough, pretty enough, thin enough, smart enough, good enough. But I think step 10 allows me to keep on. I mean, I'm sorry, I'm not giving you much hope that this is how you might look when you get, I mean, like. You know, the mind, just this narrative and this self-talk, and it's usually a negative self-talk. And so step 10 and 11, it's not about the condemnation or the negative thought life. It's about being able, I mean, step 7 talks about humility, and humility is truthful, and I'm so detached from the truth. I'm either better than you or less than you. I'm always egotistical. I'm one way or the other. And ego is edging God out, and that's how I live my life. This program in step 10 allows me to watch for those things. And I like right after that because it says when these crop up. It doesn't say if. It says when. That just kind of implies to me it will, and it does for me. And then it says we ask God. By this time, hopefully, I have a God of my understanding. And I just want to share with you, and maybe if you don't have a God of your understanding or don't believe, the book says you can choose your own conception of God. And so if you can choose your own conception of God, would you consider maybe wanting a God of love? And if a God of love sounds like good to you, then every time I mention word, just think of love. I like how it talks as it's a beginning place, and we got to have the experience, and we got to have a starting point. But right here it says we ask God at once. I know there's a lot of confusion. Is it 10th step during the day, or is it the nightly review, and on, but clearly, to me, or what I've been taught, everything I know is what I've been taught promptly at once. I mean, right here it says we ask Him at once, not tonight, now. This morning when I'm sitting up there and judging the whole situation, you know, I ask God at once to remove these things, my selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. Where am I not forgiving or compassionate and so on? Because I lack the power to remove it. I want to do better, but I can't make it happen on my own power. So the book right here reminds me that I have to have a God of my understanding. And I just did it because y'all told me to do this stuff. Y'all told me to say these prayers. And somewhere, like I'll talk about in step 11, it gradually became a working part of my mind. How did I sit there and make that happen? I remember you from South Carolina. I mean, sorry. I told y'all I was so looking forward to seeing some of the women I met a couple of months ago. So I asked God to remove them because on my own power, I can't wish them away any more than I could alcohol. And if I'm applying these things in my life throughout my day, then the 10-step promises happen. I love the 9-step promises. There's promises throughout the big book. But in the 10th step, it talks about stuff this will happen. We find this will happen automatically. We react sanely and normally. The problem's been removed. We have a new attitude and a new outlook. We're placed in a position of neutrality. If you're not feeling the promises of what I'm just talking about, what it says on page 85, maybe consider looking at, are you actively working a 10th step in your life? The promises you hear in the 9th step, if those aren't actively happening, do you owe someone amends? I can always kind of go backwards a little bit. And so by y'all teaching me this and some people having spiritual consent and calling me out on my stuff and say, you know, somebody says, oh, do you obsess a lot, Belinda? I'm like, oh, no. Well, I mean, I just clearly gave you a real short bit of how I do. And she's like, but really, Belinda, do you? I'm like, well, not really. I mean, my God, I fall asleep so quick. And the book also talks about I rest on my laurels. weekends like this, man, I don't want to look at myself. It's, you know, or when I do these big book weekends, these intensive things with small group of women and bring them through the steps and we're doing, I mean, it's just intensive work. And by that, throughout the day, I'm not looking at me. And at night, I don't want to look at an 11th step nightly review because I'm tired. I'm done. The book says we rest on our laurels, but we're headed for trouble if we do. What part of this 12-step program can I leave out and stay sober? Or maybe I will stay sober, but will I be happy, joyous, and free? For me, when I actively apply this, I can breathe. That ick on the inside just isn't eating away at me. My head's not doing like this, and I'm not running around vibrating anymore. Well, I still do that because I feed off the energy in this room. I mean, but I'm not vibrating in a negative way. It says every day, not some days. Every day is the day we must carry the vision of God's will into all our activities. And again, it's easy to do it when I'm here with y'all. Let me get on the road or get home and all of that. One of the things I didn't mention last night and somebody brought up, but I'm driven by this belief system I have. I really am. My beliefs are fueled by the fears. The fears are my driving force of life. And what happens is my belief system is going to determine how I feel. The way I feel is going to determine how I act. And that whole cycle is repeated over and over and over. And because I fall short of my chosen idea or my morals and values that I have so graciously set for myself, it fills me with guilt, remorse, and shame. And that's repeated over and over and again. If I don't get connected to the power, I'm kind of, y'all don't want to hang out with me when I'm like that. Let me just, that's all I got to say about that. And it said, yeah, but these thoughts, and I'm not talking about the earlier thoughts. I'm talking about the thoughts of the prayer and constantly staying awake and trying to watch. They must go with me constantly. Now they don't. I wish they did all the time, and I was this perfect example of a human being, a woman, and an AA member, but I'm not. But this is the directions the book gives me, and when I do this, I can breathe. And I can be there for you and for you, and I can be present for what's in front of me. And I think steps 10 always brings me back to the present moment. Because when I'm sitting up there thinking about how I'm not good as she was or how good I'm not as good as Alex was. Because I did that with Alex too. I just did a 10-step with Rachel and I had to do it again with Alex. I'm sure I'm going to do it here in a minute with Bob. I wish that was removed from me. But instead I get to get up here and say, hey, this is how I am. But what happens with a step sin, I can get back in the moment. In the moment, I can be present. Because God is in the present. May you find Him now. Now is now. Not now is not later. Now is now. I'm so grateful. And, you know, well, then it goes on saying, much has already been said about receiving strength, inspiration, and direction from Him who has all knowledge and power. Remember, like, there's one that has all power, that one is God. May you find Him now, and right here it's reminding me again, all knowledge and power, not me. The power has all the power. I'm so grateful that I have this sincere desire to form and seek this relationship with God. Step 11 says, sought through prayer and meditation. I've got to have the experience. It went from a God of my, I mean, I grew up with different, well, I'll say it, religions in my life. I mean, several different ones, right? And I came in here with a God that I didn't understand. And then y'all told me to choose my own conception. Then I thought I had a God of my understanding. And then I realized, I don't have a God of my understanding. And then it's like I'm back and forth. But what I can say is I have a God of my experience. A God of my experience that works for me today. The God of my experience today is not the same one I had yesterday or the day before or so on. It says we seek through prayer and meditation to improve this conscious, see that mind. In fact, on page 23 of the book, it says the problem centers in my mind. Any problem I have centers in my mind. Yeah, I'm trying to pull up the timer. Okay. So the nightly review, I mean, on page 86, I obviously have talked too much on 10, so I'm going to go real quick. In one full paragraph, there's a bunch of questions that we're supposed to constructively review our day. The 10 steps not about beating me up. It's just checking and watching and staying awake for. And that's the same thing as a nightly review. I'm going to watch for where I'm resentful, selfish, dishonest, and afraid. I'm going to see if I'm keeping secrets. It's in here. Now, for me, I've done the nightly review many different ways. The book doesn't say write it. I've had notebooks on the side of my bed. I do it there. An app on my phone. I've done it there. I haven't written it at all. I'll do it in my mind. I've shared it. I've emailed it to my sponsor on a regular basis. I've done it with groups of women that I sponsor to help stay accountable. And then I found I was being dishonest because I didn't want them to all know where I was. I just wanted my sponsor to know. So I don't know that there's a right way or a wrong way. I can tell you there was a time I'm telling sponsees to do it and, you know, this is good and send it to me so you can be accountable. I mean, I believe it is work between me and God, but for somebody who's undisciplined like me, I need to stay accountable. And it helped me be truthful with someone. And so this inventory, and I love how there's a prayer at the end of that again. I mean, I really learned how to pray in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And once I make this review, and it's going to be some liabilities and some assets. But I love how it says we do not drift into worry, remorse, or morbid reflection because that would diminish my usefulness to others. The whole deal here is I'm trying to stay connected to the power so that I can be useful to others. So I can live like the St. Francis prayer talks about. So that I can love you and I can understand you and I can bring you light in your darkness. But I can only do it with that power. And the prayer, like I have to ask God's corrective measures because I don't know. My mind on my own can't come up with it. I mean, I could come up with some good ideas, but man, I'm often quite wrong. And I like how it says we ask God's forgiveness. That's the only way I won't drift into that worry, remorse, or morbid reflection. So meditation, man, I love meditation. I swear, if you want to know anything about it, I will be around the rest of the weekend. Talk to me. I will be happy to share my experience that hopefully it will give you the willingness and open-mindedness to try to have your own. The book is real clear. It says, on awakening, I don't know about you, but I go to sleep every night. And I wake up a lot, but when I actually get up in the morning getting ready for the day, it says, in this section of the book, it talks about the mind so much. It uses this, we ask God to direct our thinking. That is to be divorced from selfish, dishonest, and self-seeking motives. That's how I got to start out my day. But it uses in this section of the book, mind, decisions, thought. It's all about the mind. This one, I love this, page 87, it says, being still inexperienced. So right there, it's telling me that today when I woke up, I have no experience with God. None, zero. I love that. But it says, being still inexperienced and having just made conscious contact with God, it's not probable that we are going to be inspired at all times. I'm not. And then next it says we might pay for this presumption and all sorts of absurd actions and ideas. There's a few ladies in this room that knows me. Liz is one of them. Tessair saved my ass. I'll get to that in a minute. And they watch me. They see me. They can tell you it shows up in all absurd actions and ideas. I mean, I come up with a good plan. Every plan I come up with is a good one. They don't always work out, but they're good. But it goes on to say, you know, as we go through the day, we pause. Earlier, I had to pause because I got carried away when I saw some friends from South, you know, I say South Carolina. I forget I'm in South Carolina. But I have to pause so that I can just get quiet so God can direct my thinking again. When agitated and doubtful, it reminds me that I'm going to be agitated and doubtful. We ask God for the right thought or the idea. I need to keep going back to Him. I think this literature teaches us how to pray and meditate. It says the circumstances warrant. We ask our wives and friends to join us in morning meditation. If you sleep at my house, I'm going to tell you, hey, man, I get up. And when I get up, it's going to be about this time. Do you want to do prayer and meditation with me? Or would you like me to go ahead and do it without you? Usually, yeah, they won't. They'll usually always say yes. I like the part that says we constantly, so if this is on awakening throughout my day, I'm supposed to constantly remind myself I'm no longer running the show because I constantly think that I am. humbly saying to myself many times each day, thy will be done. I usually run around and roar it through your lives like a tornado because I want my will to be done because I have the way. I have the way. Belinda's way. And so as Belinda sees it. And then it says we are then in much less danger of excitement. I'm like, wait, what? Danger of excitement? Oh, remember that newcomer I told you about? That was some exciting stuff, man. But excitement is dangerous for me, too, because I can just get excited about anything, and it doesn't mean it's in a good, healthy, spiritual way. But it's reminded me that excitement, fear, anger, worry, and self-pity, they're foolish decisions, and that's just going to get in my way, too. So if I constantly go back to God throughout my day, my life looks better, and I don't have to make so many amends. And this part, it also says we alcoholics are undisciplined. Oh, so I have to let this God of my understanding discipline me in the simple way the book is just outlined. Imperfectly, I might add. I know Bob said he was going to talk a lot about step 12, but, you know, I'm one of those people that has been placed in a position that where I can devote a lot of my time to helping other women or be in the service of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm so grateful for that. I don't have kids. I don't have a job. And I have a relationship with a man, and that, you know, of course I have family and stuff, but it does. It affords me a little opportunity to be helpful in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remember one inventory I had, and I was looking at something, and I just know my purpose in life is to help other alcoholics. And this guy that I'm using right now, she says, well, what if it isn't Belinda? Like, oh my God. Maybe it's not God's will. Because I can even get fixed on the belief system of what I believe is right. I mean, I still believe my purpose is to help other alcoholics. The book tells me so. Y'all teach me so. But I still want to be open-minded to the possibility that God has another idea. The book talks about, in the chapter Working with Others, actually from the beginning of the book, through the book, and in the whole long chapter is Working with Others. It talks about, I mean, like, we've got to be of service, and Bill and Bob, and how they did it, and the importance of that. It says, nothing ensures us immunity from drinking except for intensive work with others. Intensive work. I'm so grateful that I was taught that, and my sponsor was 50 years sober, and she'll call me every now and then. I need a newcomer. She still works with the newcomer. Well, thank you. I almost said something. Boy, that pause was not of me, just to let you know. She loves working with newcomers, and it's beautiful to watch. But in 2018, I mean, I've had several surgeries sober, pretty many of them. And in 2018, I was going to have one that turned into five. I was in bed for most of 7 months. I could barely make it to the bathroom. And it says nothing ensures me immunity. Nothing. That means no meetings, no prayer, no meditation, not a sponsor. Nothing ensures me immunity except intensive work with others. But I'm here to say during that time there was no intensive work to others. It was poor me. I wanted to die day after day. Day after day I wanted to die. And I call them my pesty sponsees. I had one, and she's here. She probably saved my life because she would call me and say, I have those amends cards. I'm coming by. And I wanted to tell her, just leave me alone. She came anyway. Thank you. And they called, and they showed up with food, and they stopped by. I wanted to die. Rachel did shared it beautifully today about the relationship and the importance of these guides. And I shared last night, I just want to be like some of you. I want to be gentle, and I want to provide a safe place for people to come to. And I want to be able to share my experience. I got lots of opinions. I got an opinion about everything. But I'm going to try to keep that out of the way, and I'm going to share my experience and go back to what the book says. If you need to make an amends to a kid, I don't know. I don't have a kid. Let me find you someone that did that. I think I have all the answers, but I don't. When we talk about don't leave before the miracle happens, if you haven't sat with another alcoholic and watched their life change as a result of this work, and oh my God, it's one of the most beautiful things to watch them help others. and then come to you and say how excited that they are. There's no high like it I've ever experienced. And I believe that's the miracle you should not miss. I'm blessed to sponsor some women, and Rachel said it too, is they do more for me than I ever think that I can do for them. But a lot of times, what I found with women I work with, and some that have a couple of decades of sobriety in there, and they, when it's sad to hear that they don't feel like they're good enough to sponsor. The truth is, I'm not good enough. But if I clear away the ick on the inside, stay connected to the power, it's the power that works through me to love you. Thank you. And I know Bob will kill it. Thanks, y'all.
Thank you. I'm Bob Bureau. I'm an alcoholic. I have a home group. It's the Connect the Dots group in Las Vegas, Nevada. And if you go there, the members of that group know I'm a member because I have jobs there. I have a sponsor who knows they're my sponsor, because if your sponsor isn't sure they're your sponsor, they're probably not. Isn't that right, Ray? And I have a sobriety date, and that's the date from which I've been free of all alcohol and anything I ever used to medicate my abstinence. And that's October 31st, 1978. And that's my personal best, actually. I'm not sure where I'm going to go with this, but I'll tell you, something popped into my mind. There was a psychiatrist back in the 50s who helped and worked with Bill Wilson. And he was a very astute guy. And he said a couple things that I've taken to heart. He said the alcoholic must have ego reduction in depth. And some of that is reprinted in AA, Comes of Age. And he gave a talk at our international. He's quoted a lot. And I get that. Chuck Chamberlain, who is my sponsor, and I got my first 5-6 years of sobriety, I'd hear Chuck every chance I could. And Chuck said one time, if it wasn't for the ego, we wouldn't even need AA. We'd just quit drinking, right? It's just the clamoring of something we don't even know is there. But you don't know it's there because it talks to you. And it talks to you in your own voice. That's the trick. That's the trick right there. And so that's not ego. That's me. And I'm right. And then Tebow talked about the amazing recuperative powers of the alcoholic ego. Man, I'm telling you, if you haven't suffered the resurgence of that in your sobriety, everyone I know that's sober over 20 years has hit these second and third and fourth surrenders because the ego grows back like a bad tumor. It just comes back. I think this 12-step process is very much like flushing a toilet. And all the water empties out from the tank. And then you can bet immediately I'll start filling up with me again. Right? Because that's the nature of a chronic spiritual malady. And so we start through this step process and we're confronted with this, with a couple propositions. One is we can't manage our own life sober. Matter of fact, my life's more unmanageable sober. I'm crazy. And I'm in this bondage of self. And I see so many similarities between ego and self-centeredness and self that I'm colorblind to the subtle differences, if there are any. I don't know. but I know I'm in the bond. I'm egocentric, as Bill likes to says we like to call it nowadays. And so I enter into this process. I clear out a whole bunch of stuff in step 4, 5. I start realizing as I process all my judgments, which is, they trick you into, in the fourth step, into writing down, they call it resentments. It's really your opinion about people list, right? It's your opinion list. Which is that? What does the ego do? That's what it does. I mean, some of us burn our lives to the ground drinking. We come into AA and the first thing we get back is our opinions, you know? So we look at all these resentments, these opinions, judgments, and then the book says we had to look at it from an entirely different angle and walks us through this thing, and this was our course, this two-part realization. If you do it in your innermost self, I'm telling you, if you do it, you'll look at everything in your life and you were wrong about your mother and you were wrong about your father and you were wrong about your ex. And it's almost like that scene in The Wizard of Oz when they throw the bucket of water on the witch. I'm melting! You know, it's just ego reduction at depth. But it comes back. And so a step that I've never been too far away from, 6. I think 6 is the real surrender. Very difficult to do. Entirely ready? I'm entirely ready to have God remove the consequences of a lot of this stuff. And then we make the amends, and the amends is dramatic. Every time I faced someone I was terrified to face, my trust in Alcoholics Anonymous, my trust in my sponsor, and my trust in God got stronger. Got stronger. And then I get to step 10, and by the time I get to my first run through the steps, and I've been through them many, many times. Now, spiritual giants don't have to do that. But I leak a lot, you know. Wilson, thank God Wilson said no one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence. So I go back through the steps every few years because it's more than a 10th step can handle. I've come up with amends and resentments from the past that weren't on previous inventories. As you wake up, you peel the layers of the onion off and more is disclosed. And so I get to step 10, and I get to step 10 with a lot of knowledge. And I never, if you would have told me that the steps are going to reduce my ego and build it at the same time, I wouldn't have believed you. And yet, what my ego always has fancied, that it will find power and significance in knowledge. And I came out the backside of a lot of that with a lot of knowledge. I was one of the first big book technicians. I'm ashamed to say that, actually. I would go to meetings and correct people on how they're not sharing properly about a certain step. You know, I was that guy. Jesus. And so I guess my sponsor wanted me to start doing step 10. And I'm going to do that. But if you would have watched my position and my actions, you would have easily come to the conclusion that to Bob, step 10 says, we continued to take personal inventory, and if he was ever wrong, he would promptly admit it, right? And so I'm missing a lot here. And then, you know, you get in the pain, you get pain in sobriety is the return of the ego of self. And you start to fill up with yourself again, as a lot of us do. Not because we're bad people. It's the chronic nature of the spiritual malady. And I started taking step 10 a little more seriously. But I didn't know. Wilson's so brilliant. I don't know. It's so insightful. I don't know how in 1939, 38 and 39, he knew that so many of us, all these years later, are going to have difficulty with this because as a result of sobriety, we're going to get big, huge lives. And when you have a big, huge lives and you're running a company with a lot of employees or you got kids and you got commitments and you got the phones ringing, you get 60, 80 phone calls a day from sponsees, you got a big, huge life and something comes up that you really should stop and do the five things in the book. And you'll get to it. You know what I mean? Did you ever get that's a terrible thing to say to yourself. I'll get to it. Which means I'm not going to do it. And so I'll get to it. And then what happens is it builds up. It's like sticking stuff under the rug. You get a lumpy rug that'll trip your ass up a lot, right? So I'm doing that and not realizing it. And then I started to realize, well, when do I pause? When do I stop and do those five things? And in the early 50s, with more experience in Alcoholics Anonymous, Bill wrote something in step 10, in the 12 steps and 12 traditions, that is the road sign. And he says it's a spiritual axiom, which means something true under all conditions. It's a spiritual axiom that when I'm disturbed at all, no matter what the reason, no matter what the cause, Bob, there's something wrong with you. You need some correction here. And the disturbance, and here's one of the things it took me a while to realize, excitement is a disturbance. I mean, did you ever notice how excitement always leads? Well, I am excited because I think I'm going to have some fun. Did you ever notice how trouble always starts out looking like fun? So when I'm disturbed at all, no matter what the cause, it's time you got something to do here, Bob. You got to call your sponsor. You got to try to identify what is it? Is it resentment? Is it selfishness? So is it about you again, Bob? Is it fear? Is it dishonesty? It's not really dishonesty if there's a little bit of truth in it, is there? I'm not dishonest. I'm creative with reality. You know, I have a little bit of literary license. I mean, isn't that? That's not terrible. And it's dishonest. And so I do that so I can be of maximum service. And then I got to step 11, and I didn't do step 11 out of the book, unfortunately, for probably 20 years. But I did a lot of stuff. You know, I grew up in meditation. I went to transcendental meditation. I went to Divine Light Mission, Guru Maharaji. I found truth in seeking the light. I did all kinds. I did Raja Yoga. I did the lion. I did all that. I did a lot of stuff. And so I get to the big book. And the first, it says, we're going to give you some definite and valuable suggestions about prayer and meditation. Step 10. First thing it starts is an inventory process. And here's the problem with people like myself, that you've become egocentric and you don't know it. Egocentric people don't follow any directions that they don't agree with. So for 20 years, I didn't do step 11 out of the book. I did a lot of stuff. I mean, I got Course in Miracles for a while. I did that. I'd still do this to this, the prayer of St. Francis, this thing today, to this day I use. I am the place where God shines through. Him and I are one, not two. I need not worry, fret, or plan. He wants me where and as I am. And if I could be relaxed and free, He'll carry out His plan through me. I'd use that. I explored churches. This is really amazing, but the church of my childhood, I went back there, it had changed. I'd probably go there to this day if they let me share once in a while. I mean, you know. Now, that's a spotlight on my ego right there, I'll tell you. And so I discovered that Wilson in the 12 Steps, 12 Traditions says that this self-examination is a part of step 11. It's designed to mix with meditation and prayer. And our description of what the book says in step 11 about meditation is really more along the lines of contemplation. If you look at Emmett Fox's description of the three vehicles to God. But regardless, when they're mixed together, Wilson says that this is not about relief anymore. It's about creating a unshakable foundation for life. I need that. I don't need any more relief. I'm a relief junkie. I don't need more relief. I'm like, when it comes to relief, sometimes I'm like the rat. I don't want any more of that cheese. I just want out of the trap. I'm a relief seeker. Because that's what selfish people do. We seek to feel better. We seek the relief. We seek the freedom from discomfort. And so I started doing that. And I do 2 hours every morning. Now, not all that's prayer and meditation. It's also considering the plans for the day, looking at what's on my plate. How am I going to bring God into this? I got people to call back. Et cetera, et cetera. Every day is like that. But it's a better... When I started doing the 2 hours in the morning, I think the greatest thing about that, it's not what I do in the 2 hours. It's that I give that time to my recovery. It's a demonstration in a busy life of something that's important to me. All right? So I do that. I want to talk a little bit about step 12. I think it's... Why do we do all this? One of the differences between the step 11 process in the big book and all the other things I did, the visualizations, the breathing exercises, the chanting, all of it, is that those things are great, but they're self-serving. They're designed for me and my well-being to be better. In Alcoholics Anonymous, we're doing all of this so we can be more effective. Matter of fact, everything we do in AA is to serve the end of step 12. The third step decision is to take away these difficulties with this bondage of self for one reason. So that victory over them would bear witness to those they would help. And I'm asking God to take away, not everything, but to take away the things that stand in the way of my usefulness. That Alcoholics Anonymous is trying to take a selfish, self-obsessed, self-serving, self-focused, self-absorbed guy like me, who's just full of himself, and turn me, empty me out of me, and continue to empty me out of me so that I can be a servant. That's the highest you get here. Look at the second tradition. It's the only organization on the planet where you can come in a big shot and work your way up to servant. I mean, there's no place like that except AA. And it is, Wilson refers to it as our primary purpose, which is very different because I came here with a primary purpose, as I suppose you did. What's your primary purpose, Bob? Me, my relationships, my finances, my job, what you think of me, and me. And you guys are saying, do that thing in the prayer of St. Francis, Bob, you got to forget yourself. Set yourself aside. Don't be such a selfish guy. Set yourself aside and serve a greater and more noble purpose than you. And that's helping God's kids. A purpose that, when you think about it objectively, I've been more divinely crafted for that than anything. And I ran a huge company, made millions and millions of dollars. Nothing. I am divinely crafted to help people that are sick like I'm sick, who struggle with self-centered fear way into their sobriety, as I have and do. Who struggle with this bondage of self in their sobriety as I do. Who couldn't even see any of this stuff when I got here because the blinds were drawn. And people in AA introduced me to me. You shared about you. and you introduced me to me. And so I'm divinely crafted by my mistakes, by my failures, by my defects, to be amazingly useful. Matter of fact, if you're new here, I can promise you something. You stay in this thing, the worst thing about you, the thing that you've swept so far under the rug you don't want anybody to know about, will become a useful tool in your future when it comes to helping people. If you buy your primary purpose and you try to set yourself aside. Wilson, in his story, said something that was very, very astute. I think it's brilliant. He said, unless the alcoholic can perfect and enlarge his spiritual life, and it's not through what you'd think. It's not through prayer and meditation. Even though prayer and meditation are vital, it's through self-sacrifice, constant thought of others, their needs, and how we can work for them. It says that a couple times in the book. Our very lives as ex-problem drinkers spend on a constant thought of others. Who did they write that for? Al-Anons? Constant thought of others? I mean, oh my God, how can you do that? I mean, I'm not wired that way. And yet, and not truly, truly, my default position is me and self. But if you'd follow me around, you'd see that a big, big piece, most of my life is dedicated through my actions, not my intentions, not my feelings, but through my actions to serving. I'm on the phone all the time. I sponsor a lot of guys. I do 2 to 3 hospital and institution panels a week. And I've done that for over 43 years, nonstop. No, sir. Throw money. I'm on committees. I do the service, and I've also, my first sponsor said, you do it all. And there are people that try to talk me out of it. Oh, you don't want to be a GSR. That's political. I spent 9 years in general service. I got to tell you, I learned more about AA and more. I learned how to you will fall in love with whatever you serve. And you'll continue to be in love with whatever you serve. So you have people in your home group that seem to be in love with Alcoholics Anonymous, and you're missing the boat. Become a servant here. Get jobs in Alcoholics Anonymous. The more inconvenient, the better. Oh, the better. I hope you're prepared to be, as my friend Larry says, to be divinely inconvenienced. I think in spiritual coinage, the higher the inconvenience, the greater the spiritual coinage. I mean, if you only do service and things in AA that you feel like doing, I mean, what's different? You've done that all your life. And so we serve here. And I'll tell you, I've learned more about myself, and more, I've learned more about this program and helping others. You know, it's like you have a feeble attempt to give something to someone, and in the attempt of giving it to someone, you'll get it at a level you didn't have it before. We get what we give here. I was brand new. I was maybe a week out of the detox, I guess, and I met this Skid Row club that was the only AA place I felt comfortable, because it was the kind of AA meetings where people would fall out of their chair and have a seizure in the meeting. They wouldn't even stop the meeting, they'd just keep talking, you know. Somebody would stick a wallet in the guy's mouth so he didn't bite his tongue, you know. It's one of those kind of places. A lot of hookers, a lot of drug dealers. I mean, it was just like real Skid Row. It was on Las Vegas Boulevard in North Las Vegas, one of the worst sections. And there was a bottomless, topless strip joint on one side and a pawn shop on the other. It was kind of spiritually nestled in there, you know? And I'd go there. When I got out of the detox, I'd start going there a couple times a day because I felt comfortable there. I didn't feel comfortable at a lot of the high-end meetings. Felt comfortable there. And I remember one day, I was my first week, a guy comes, this old-timer. To me, he was an old-timer. He probably had 4 or 5 years. I don't know. But he came up to me, and he said, I need your help. And I was all ears. I thought, oh, yeah. Because, you know, I feel awkward. I don't feel like I fit there, really. It's like, you know how people in AA look clicky? It's like all of them are all together, and then there's me. You know, that thing. And he said, I need your help. And I said, well, yeah, what can I do? He said, well, we get a lot of new people here. And they did. And he said, we need someone who's brand new to make them feel welcome and talk to them. And I thought, oh, I don't know how to do it. He said, we have been sober a long time. The memory of how difficult it is to come to AA and the awkwardness of coming into a room full of strangers is left most of us. It hasn't left you yet. We need you to go up to those new people and no profundities. You're not going to take them through the steps. You're going to go up to them and you're going to let them know they're not alone. You're going to go up to them and make them feel welcome and let them know that you know how they feel. And I thought, I can do that. I don't have any wisdom. I don't have any, but I can do that. And I'll tell you something. I don't know, truly looking back, I don't know if I ever made one person feel welcome in Alcoholics Anonymous except me. That became my place, and you leave the new people alone. This is my job. You know what I mean? Right? It was like, it lit me up. And I felt it was my first feeling with something, a feeling of something I don't know that I ever felt before, maybe. And I think it's more important than happiness. It's more important than relief. It's more important than anything. And it's the feeling of usefulness. Mark Twain said one time that the two most important days in any human being's life is the day you were born and then the day you realized why. You know, the big shot in me wants to imagine my life as I'm going to do the Nobel Prize or, all that grandiosity stuff. But I've been given a very simple and very noble and honorable purpose in my life. And that's to help people like me. A purpose that selfish, self-absorbed, self-serving people like myself, we don't warm up to that initially. But after you've done it for a while, you'll see that it lights you up. It really, if you're new, this will sound so weird, but it's so true. It intermittently does inside of me what bottles of whiskey that I bought intermittently did inside of me. And what is that? It sets you free. And there's only one freedom, and it contains all freedoms. And that's freedom from the bondage of self. I've gone to meetings in maximum security penitentiaries in California where they're full of guys doing multiple life sentences in prison. And earlier in the week, I was at a meeting at one of those high-end AA clubs where everybody's driving a BMW or a Mercedes or a Porsche or even a couple Bentleys in the parking lot, you know, and they're in there whining and moping of that stuff. And, yeah, I get good maid service, and you know. I'm in a maximum penitentiary with lifers who are freer, and they'll never get out of prison. They're freer. They're laughing. They're free because they're free from the bondage of self because they're working with guys in there. They found their primary purpose even in prison. And I've been given this primary purpose, and it's saved my life. I'll tell you one little quick story. You know, when Wilson says in the beginning of working with others that nothing will so much ensure immunity from drinking as intensive work with other alcoholics, Mary Emma's here. Mary Emma and John saved my life when I was 11 years sober. I went through one of the toughest patches of road I've been through in my sobriety. I was in a relationship for 6 years, married for four and a half, had a 2-year-old daughter, and all of a sudden I'm going through a divorce that I don't understand, and the day after the divorce was final, my wife and daughter moved in with my best friend, a guy I sponsored, and I discovered through the whole last year of my marriage, they'd been sneaking around having an affair. I can't even put into words how sick that made me in here. My life was in danger. And I remember this like it was yesterday. My daughter, I love my daughter. And I think because of my love for her and the connection I made with her in the delivery room, I fought for my place with her and fought to make amends and fought to do all the stuff that I didn't want to do, that if it wouldn't have been for my daughter, I might not have done. But I did. And I wasn't very, but a couple weeks into this, and my daughter and my ex-wife of just a little short period of time are living with my sponsee. And I finally got enough courage, because I had legal rights to see my daughter. I just didn't know if I had the emotional ability, because I had to go over to where they're living together to get her. And I remember the terrible feelings I had inside of myself going over there. But I wanted to see her. I had that heartache. And those of you who have kids, if you don't see them for a long time, you get that heartache, right? And I had that heartache. And I went over there and I parked in front where they lived, and I went up to the door and rang the doorbell, and the frickin' happy couple answers the door. You know, oh, Jesus. Why do you have to look happy? I mean, Jesus. There you go. Glad to see me. And they bring Kate out. Kate's the cutest little 2-year-old girl you've ever seen. She's adorable. And I take her by the hand and we go off to spend the day. I had this really cool day planned for her. We went to Chuck E. Cheese. She loved Chuck E. Cheese. Worst pizza in the world. And for, you know, for $100, I won her a 10-cent ring, you know, with the games and stuff, right? And then we went to a ranch that was... The ranch was owned by the people who had the show Legends in Concert. And a friend of mine had kept horses there, and she invited us over there to ride and play with the animals. They had a lot of animals, big ranch. My daughter loves animals, to this day, loves animals. So we go over there, and she's playing with the rabbits and feeding the different animals. And they bring a little Shetland pony out. Now, she's only 2 years old. She's big for her age, but she's only 2 years old. So she's a little scared. We put her on the Shetland pony because she was love pony. She was pony and Minnie Mouse crazy. And we put her on this pony. We walked her around the corral a couple times. And it was exciting to her. She loved it. And then we're sitting at this picnic bench, and they're taking the pony back to the stables. And I'm sitting there with my friend who's involved in the ranch, and Kate. And Kate's thirsty. So across the yard, on the wall of the stable, is a soda machine, soda pop machine. And I said to my friend, would you stay here with Katie? I'm going to go get some cans of soda pop. I walked across the yard and got a couple cans. And coming back, I hear the woman who's with my daughter say to my daughter, Kate, here comes your daddy. And Kate looks at me, looks at the woman and says, that's not my daddy. And she mentioned the guy's name. He's my daddy. Oh, I took my breath away. Felt like someone stuck a knife up under my rib cage and twisted it. I didn't say nothing. I pushed it down, and I spent the rest of the afternoon with my daughter. And I had to take her home for dinner, and I take her to pull up in front of the house. I take her by the hand, walk her up to the door, ring the doorbell, and happy couple answers the door, and she jumps into his arms, and I walk away, and I get in my car, and I drive about a block away, and I pull over. I can't drive. I'm coming apart. And I'm sitting in the car on the side of the road, and I'm sobbing and talking to God at the same time. And what I'm really saying to God is, God, I love my daughter, but I'm not big enough for this. I can't do this. This hurts too much. And I said, I'm sorry, God, but I can't see her anymore. And I'd made the decision to cut her out of my life because it was too painful. And I looked at the clock on the dashboard, and I had to meet this knucklehead sponsee down at one of the AA clubs. And I don't want to go meet him. I need to go home and think. You know? Truly, that's my natural default position. Let me hole up somewhere and think, you know. But you guys have brainwashed me. AA 101. Do what you said you're going to do. Show up where you said you're going to show up. Be early. On and on and on. And I, oh, crap, the voices of people in AA in my head. So I race across town. The guy's standing on the sidewalk in front of the AA club. I said, get in the car, and we're going across town to a book study. He's not even in the car a minute. He starts crying. And he says to me, I've been denied by the courts again to see my kids. And I'm looking at his pain. And it was like a postcard from God. Dear Bob, there's only one person that can stop you from seeing your daughter, and that's you. And it shifted my whole world, my whole intention, that I'm going to go next week and I'm going to spend a day with her and I'm going to keep doing that. She's very important to me. She just gave me my first grandson. He's beautiful and looks somewhat like me. What can I say? And that new guy that I picked up at that club, he thinks I'm helping him. He saved me from me. The helpers get the help here. If you're sober a while, I've been doing a thing at detoxes for over 43 years. If I run into people almost weekly, not every week maybe, but very frequently, who drink again with multiple years of sobriety. There was one guy at 45 years. Bill Wilson had been his sponsor. And he drank again. I've met people with 10 years, a lot of over 10, that drink again. And I want to know. I want to know because I don't want that to happen to me. I want to know what did they do that they should have done and what didn't they do that they should have did. And you'd think, if some of you in the room are probably thinking, I bet you they stopped going to meetings. No. No. I bet you they didn't really work the steps. I've seen guys in there that taught the steps. They were big book technicians. Well, they didn't have a relationship with God, evidently. I've seen clergy. I've seen people that pray more and have a better relationship with God than I'll probably ever have. So what's the common denominator with all of them? Ask, if you ever do this and you see somebody sober over 10 years in a detox, go up to them and say this to them. Say, I am really, really sorry you're here. I'd like to help. If you'll give me the names and phone numbers of the new guys in their first 60 days you've been working with, I'll be glad to step up. I'll be glad to contact them and offer to help. They won't give you any names. Because their primary purpose has become themselves. And they didn't know it. And they didn't know it. And I know about that. I sunk into the one depression I had of any consequence in 43 years. I had it when I was 19 years sober. In a year that I made more money, had more toys, more motorcycles, more fancy cars. In the midst of a life that I should have been just crying tears of gratitude for having, I sunk into a depression. Chronic dissatisfaction. And I couldn't have told you what. And it was because my primary purpose had become me. I didn't even know it. You don't do that overnight, most of us. It's like a glacier-like movement. Slow. You cut things out incrementally, one thing at a time. Maybe now you're, when a newcomer asks you for a ride, I'm just too busy. I got something to do. And you don't even try to find them a ride with someone. Maybe now, instead of answering the phones or are going on 12-step calls. You're busy. Maybe you say something that I've heard guys say. It makes me sick to my stomach. Oh, I've done that years ago. Let the new people do it. Right? I've seen during the pandemic, because of an I had to work to do 12-step calls. I answered the phones for central office. I found institutions who would still let us bring panels in, masked up and socially distanced. But I was more afraid of dying of alcoholism than I was COVID. And I found my way, but it was a little more work. A little more effort, a little more inconvenience. But it's my life. I tell you, you can't be sober long enough that you can't get drunk again. And I know guys in the last year that with over 25 years, 30 years, 15 years that have drank. And I tell you, I hope this isn't true. Some of them died, but the ones that didn't die, they're trying to get sober again. And the progression of this disease is brutal. And what progresses is the ego. Do you ever try to talk to someone and help someone who had been 20 years sober and drank again? They know everything. No matter what you say to them, they go, oh, yeah, I know. Uh-huh, yeah, I know. Uh-huh, I know. Yeah. I think what they're really thinking is, yeah, I know. Shut up. Yeah, I don't. Shut up. You can't help them. And because their receiver is shut down. It's blocked with ego. And that's what blocks us. When you come here, you've got to be crushed enough to receive help. Because we're not people who receive help. We're too self-reliant for that. But if you're lucky, you've been crushed enough to receive the help. And follow the directions of a sponsor. And if you're new here, I hope you have a mean, unreasonable sponsor. I hope he asks you on a regular basis to do things, and the minute he asks you, you just go, oh, God. Because he will lead you out of the darkness and into the light. Alcoholics Anonymous has saved my life. It's given me, it's more than that. I never had much of a life. You know, I look back at my childhood. My parents were wonderful. I had a lot of love in my life. But when I look at my childhood, the only thing I remember with any clarity is me. That's not much of a life when it's all about you, right? I mean, my mother used to try to tell me that. She'd say, you're full of yourself. I didn't just go over my head and go, what do you mean? Of course I'm full. That's just me. You know, I don't. She said one time, you're the center of the universe. You think you're the center of the universe. I was just a little kid. I went like this. I went, I am, Mama. Everything revolves around me. My mother said to me one time, she said, a person wrapped up in themselves makes a pretty small package. So maybe you're not new. Maybe you're sober a number of years and you don't sponsor anybody and you don't do service. Boy, if I could do one thing, just one thing this weekend, it'd be to get you to do that. I'll tell you, my sponsor pushed me into 12-step work and sponsoring guys before I'd worked the 12 steps. Because he knew. You're on step 3 starting step 4 and you got a guy that you're taking through step 1. He's breathing down your neck. That'll propel you into the work. Because, you know, what would happen if he got ahead of me? I'm supposed to be his sponsor, for God's sakes. Isn't it? AA's beautiful. It's beautiful. It's the only place on the planet that I could come and you would use my ego to trick me into taking actions I never would have taken. Never. I used to do stupid 12-step calls. I mean, I get a call. I was on the hotline. I get a call at 3 o'clock in the morning from some guy. He doesn't want to be sober. He doesn't want to go to AA. It's 3 o'clock in the morning. He's lonely and he's run out of vodka, for God's sakes. So he's calling the helpline. He's calling Alcoholics Anonymous. So, but he gets me, and I put on my white cape. I find out where he lives, and I rush over there, listening to the tune, the theme song from Mighty Mouse, Here I Come to Save the Day. And I did more harm than good. But every time I failed, just as Bill Wilson failed in his first 96 attempts, every time I failed, I learned something. Every time I failed, I tried to see how I could do it. I talked to my sponsor about it, and he said, don't you think you should find out first if the guy wants to quit drinking? Well, he called me. You know, he's going to quit drinking or I'll kill him. You know? And every time I made a mistake, I learned from it. And I tell you, I don't think it's a mistake if you miss taking from the experience. I took from all those experiences. Did some damage, probably. I shudder to think, but there might have been some people in my first year or two of sobriety that I 12-stepped that because of my self-righteousness and BS, they may never come to AA. Because I was their first glimpse of recovery. I was their first example of the big book and the steps and the traditions. And I wasn't that good of an example. But it's a work in progress. Thank you for listening.
Linda, Bob, thank you very much for reminding us that inaccurate self-appraisal is the most ego-deflating thing that we can do, and it brings us into the light, and reminding us that the inconveniences are where the biggest spiritual coin is. I like that. And thank you guys very much for sharing with us, sharing your experience, strength, and hope with all of us. I hope everybody enjoyed the workshop. Woo!